It's Saturday, June 23rd, 2012. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. It's time now for Geek Speak.
We're through being cool. We're through being cool. Eliminate the minis and the twits.
Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, I have Alan Luckow. Al Luckow's a new media architect. Good morning, Al.
Hi, everybody.
It's been a while.
Yes, it has.
It's good to see
here
you.
Here I am.
And Alex Leas. And Alex Leas is an information security analyst. Hi.
Hey, good morning.
And a bit of a security expert? Dabbler.
I dabble.
We're going to be doing geek news the entire show today, and I'm going to go ahead and start with Mr. Luckow because it's been so long, sir.
Yes, it has. Well, there's been a couple of interesting things. One of the things that I ran across... You're aware that RIM is the company that makes the BlackBerry phone.
Formerly the most popular portable device in the world.
Everybody had. Some people called it the CrackBerry, and yeah. Obama used one and all this kind of stuff. Well, and then Apple came out with their silly touch screen that they didn't think was worth doing. Well, it turns out now RIM is in trouble because everybody's using these smartphones. Now Android phones are coming out and everything. Well, one of the suppliers for RIM, the what they call an OEM that makes the parts that build these things, mm-hmm. is withdrawing from RIM's being a supplier for RIM, and it's costing them $35 million to stop making bits for RIM's BlackBerry.
Wait. They're paying to not make software for RIM anymore?
Yep.
So locked into some kind of contract, I guess.
They're Toronto-based. The name of the company is Celestica. With a C, and it is announced that it's going to stop making hardware for RIM over the next 3 to 6 months, and it's going to cost them $35 million to structure RIM out of its hair once and for all.
Wow.
Which is a lot of money to spend to just get rid of a client, which does not look good for RIM.
No.
Wow, that's crazy.
Nothing lately has looked good for RIM,
no.
But this is pretty bad.
They're just the whole button keyboard business. I think they should have...
Yeah, I guess that was the problem.
Yeah.
Well, so okay, that's kind of sad.
One of the reasons is the BlackBerry 10, which is RIM's new smartphone, isn't going to be coming out until late this year.
Well, you also see the numbers, and the iPhone and Android market is just shooting up still.
Well, at the same time,
RIM is decreasing.
At the same time, their late product is going to come out. They're going to be facing increased competition from Apple's iPhone, which is going to be the new iPhone's going to be coming out probably around then. And there's going to be like a smattering of Android smartphones. There's a variety of them coming out at the same time. It's just, this is no, you know, you just, they're beat, I think.
Yeah.
Although for a commercial market, I believe they're still dominant in commercial use for corporations and such, just
really?
Because they integrate so well with enterprise systems.
Yeah, that's
Apple,
one of the first rev of Apple definitely didn't work at all.
Even still, it's really
still difficult.
Barely.
Are you? They use the company you work for. Or you work at a large bank?
Not officially. Well, no, I don't work at a bank. I work technically an insurance company, but.
Oh,
yeah, I mean, we officially have BlackBerries, but.
Yeah, nobody uses.
We have to support what's out there, and people use iPhones. We have, Android phones. I mean, it's there, and we have to support it. When an executive says they want their new iPhone, they get their new iPhone.
Now, Alex, thanks for coming in. You're a photographer quite a bit. You do that professionally as well. And you have any stories on like large cameras?
Large cameras,
or like room size cameras, even.
Room-size cameras. Okay, yeah, you can talk a little bit about a room-size camera. Camera obscura. It's a term, photographers who at least study a little bit of history of photography know what this is. Imagine you take a room and you poke a little hole. It's a sealed-off room, so it's dark. And you poke a little hole in one side of the room that effectively becomes your aperture or input for light. And on the opposite side of the room, you actually see a projection of what is on the exterior of that room. So through that little hole, it projects it out onto the entire wall.
It's upside down, though.
Yes, it's upside down, reversed.
You know, I just real quick.
Yeah.
I used to work at a, you know, right out of school, I worked at this printers, and this was in the 80s. And they had a dark room, but it was just kind of makeshift. And so you would go in there to develop the stats and stuff. And you'd have to close the drape. It was just a drape. It was black drape. And I remember closing it one time, and there was this little tiny hole in the drape. And when the room was black, the actual outside did get projected into the dark room on the wall.
Because
it was a little room, you know?
You essentially had created a camera obscura there.
And this
is not new technology, by the way. This is 1700s.
Yeah, in fact, it's assumed that some painters in the Renaissance period used that technique.
Yeah.
To see what's going on.
Yep.
That's why they got... but go on.
Yep.
That's the reason for all the upside-down paintings.
Exactly. So anyway, the problem with... I mean, well, not problem, but the thing is, when you have a larger hole in the wall, say a window instead of just a little tiny hole, it just looks like a whole bunch of light in the room, right? Well, technically, it's still a projection. It's just a very, very blurry projection on the wall such that the light just meshes together and looks like a big single blur of light.
Mm-hmm.
But if somebody walks in front of the window, you can see their shadow and you can see how, you know, there's certain colors that may be blocked as they walk past the window and are blocking the light. Well, a couple of computer scientists at MIT worked out that if you have a picture of the projection, the blurred projection on the wall, which is just a, you know, blur of light, and then you have one where it's blocked by, say, somebody passing in front of the window, some sort of shadow. Using the math, they can actually compare all the pixels of images and identify what specifically has been blocked by that individual and come up with a relatively sharp rendering of what is actually outside that room.
Is this only for multiple images, like a video type of thing, or is it even for...
You could do this with two shots.
Wow.
That's amazing.
And, you know, using the basic math, understanding the circle of confusion with light, with a, you know, how large the window is. But, I mean, imagine, say, you have some sort of SWAT team going in, and all they can see is the projection in a room. They can actually maybe see what's on the other side of that window or door or something like that.
Right.
So you
really
can get a lot of interesting use for forensics, investigations. I'm sure even military uses this.
It makes sense this kind of stuff is becoming more popular. I mean, we know about complex Photoshop filters that are doing resharpening and kind of analyzing data. So when you get multiple data sets of an image, you really can pull quite a bit of data out of it.
Yeah, and the math you can do with just understanding the physics of the light is interesting because you get, like you were saying, with some plugins on Photoshop, they're actually been working on being able to identify the circle of confusion for individual points and instantly sharpen an image that has blur or even motion blur, detecting what the angle of motion and the pixel and light comparisons and remove the motion blur, which is just crazy.
What's the camera you have,
I was going to say, the Lytro.
Yeah.
The same thing, a light field camera. It just takes in every aperture setting. And then when you have the picture, it's interactive, and you can click to the area and change the depth of field. It's not a matter of just changing blurriness like you would in some of these tilt shift photos. It's actually a regular planar, it's a multi-dimensional picture.
It actually captures the rays of light in which direction they're coming from, so it can reconstruct the almost three-dimensional aspect of the original picture.
It's a neat camera, too.
Yeah. This kind of technology is going to become more and more common. We're going to see this recreating.
We'll see them in our iPhone soon.
Yeah.
That'd be neat.
Did you say iPhone?
iPhone.
Oh, I think it's iPhone. I liked iPhone.
I probably did.
iPhone, that's the one they sell in China.
Oh, I see.
It's off-white.
Speaking of iPhone and Apple, got any Apple stories, like maybe early Apple?
Yes. I don't know if anybody's heard this in the news, but a functioning Apple One has just been sold by Sotheby's for $374,500.
This is the one that doesn't even have a case, right? It's just a board.
It's just a board. It was originally hand-built by Steve
Your
Wozniak.
Friend.
Yep. and it's working.
Oh.
And they say that there's probably only about 50 of these in existence that could possibly be in existence. And of that, this is one of the few that's probably one of the working ones. So it actually works.
So what you're saying is that a machine that was built by hand, kind of, by a friend of yours, is now selling for $374,000.
Yeah. Well, it was the first
Apple. Why doesn't Woz just start making more?
Just make another one.
Make another one, Will.
Well, Woz, I need one. Well, I actually saw this, and I talked to Woz about this, and I asked him. I said, asked him if he sees this kind of money being paid for a piece of technology. Is it elevating the object to an art form, or is it more just sort of a historical relic to you? I asked him, what do you think about this big thing? And he emailed me back and he said, it's just a rare relic. He said, every computer before Apple I just had a front panel and some blinking lights, and every computer after had a keyboard and video. So he said, this is just it's a pivotal thing. It's a relic. He's just very, he doesn't like to.
He's still downspoken, isn't he? Yeah, the only reason every computer has video after the fact is because he invented it.
Right. Well, he thought, you should put that in there, you know. Yeah. Maybe it should have color, you know, and I'm going to make this oscillate so it turns into color. You know, so you know, amazing. The contributions he's made are amazing, and he just doesn't want to really even.
So to be clear, that's a quote from Steve Wozniak.
Yeah.
All right. About the Apple One. Now, when the Apple One was first sold, they had some crazy price on it that was funny more than anything else.
$666.66.
Right, okay.
And
why did it do that? Was it the sign?
You know, Woz just likes numbers that repeat, and he likes things that are easy to type. And people have said, oh, it's because it's the number of the beast. And all, he's like, well, I didn't know anything about any of that stuff. But I just liked 666. It just was really easy, and we didn't want to do 5555. Because that wasn't enough, and you know, 7777 was too much. So just 6666. You know, it's he didn't even never occurred to him that people might read more into it than that.
But it's interesting that price point. That's about the price of a brand new iPhone, right? Isn't that about that, or is iPhone even more expensive?
Isn't that odd?
Mm. Yeah, I just think it's neat that under $1,000, but pretty close to it, kind of space. That two thirds is kind of a space that we see a lot. But man, these machines, the Apple One, did not do much. I mean, it was really impressive.
Not really.
Time of the day.
It was groundbreaking, you know, in the sense that it added a few things. But, you know, when you think about what our phone does right now.
But Apple II, man, that was amazing. I mean, we had one of those.
The Apple II, it broke the barrier of everything.
And then, of course, the Mac Plus. Anyway, we could go through that. Mm-hmm. We won't continue that. Let's go on. Alex, your turn, sir.
All right. You ever wonder, I mean, you guys have read Reddit, right?
Yes.
You've heard of this website.
Describe what Reddit is for us.
Reddit is basically, you know, website where people put links to websites, more or less. And there's a lot of commentary and discussion.
And it's ranked. People get to rank and talk more about it. And people push it up, it's kind of like a popularity of topics.
It's a way to kind of identify popular topics and all that stuff, or popular websites, articles, whatever.
Trending topics.
Yeah.
It's also kind of like a bookmarking management system, too, for yourself, if you want to do it that way. But
right. Well, you say it's fairly huge, right?
I would say.
It's a popular website?
Yeah.
You know how they got started?
How?
They faked it.
What do you mean?
There's actually a video, and we'll link to it afterwards, from the founder who explained how they got started and some of the challenges they dealt with. And one of the things they were trying to figure out was, how do we get people to use this site? It's like, you know, it's fairly basic. They just want to share some simple information, a link, maybe a description or a summary or something like that, and then be able to have comments. And so they basically had the team that started up Reddit created a whole bunch of fake accounts, and they just posted as different people to create the appearance that there's an active community, which then makes new people coming to the site saying, oh, you know, there's people here. I'll take part of that. And because
what size was the fake size? Do you know?
I'm not sure how many accounts they actually created. I don't recall if he said that in the interview or in the.
But priming it with a community is important. Yeah, you run a community site for bearded dragon
and
lizards.
It takes a while to get that going. I mean, when I first started mine, I didn't create a whole bunch of fake sites or fake accounts, but I was actively answering any question. If somebody happened to ask a question, instantly. And it was a very slow growth. Their method, I mean, I wish I thought of that. Their method is way faster to get a community up and growing.
Did they remove that content so the lie went away? Yeah. Or is it still there in the archive?
I don't know. I'd be curious if you can identify what the accounts were.
Reddit was primed with falsehoods.
Yep. Tons of fake accounts.
And now everything on there is true.
Was real. Well, the content was real. It was just the accounts that posted them created the illusion that there was more people actively using it.
I don't know about the content being real. I mean, isn't a big part of Reddit about what people are saying about it? I mean, that's the whole point.
But as a founder to a site, you have an idea for what you want it to be.
Right.
You're basically seeding it with what you want it to be.
Yeah, and they got to set the tone of that as
well.
Exactly. So if you're not familiar with Reddit, do spend some time. But be warned, you will probably spend way too much time over and over again if you're there.
And I was going to say, we'll put up the link to this. It's interesting because he doesn't just cover that. He talks about some of the other challenges, like, you know, what they wanted it to be, what fields do they want to have available, and even just simple things like, you know, do we even want people to have to enter an email address when they register? They actually thought about, you know, no, we don't. Why do you want somebody to leave your browser to go to an email program when you want them to be able to just quickly and instantly get in and comment or post something?
So it's really easy to post.
Yeah.
Really easy to comment. Now, I've been using a site like that for years, or I used to use it. Slashdot was the one that I first used in that form, very similar. And then
when you commented there and you didn't leave your address, they would say anonymous coward.
Right, that's how they'd sign it. That's right, anonymous
coward. Do they still say that?
Probably. Yeah. I have an account there. I haven't gone there forever. Al, you're a designer. You work at a desk all day. Uh-huh. Got any new furniture tips?
Well, here's a cool desk. And this is, it started out as a concept desk. But then the guy, I guess he's selling these things now. It's for designers who constantly doodle. It's a giant post-it note desk. So imagine a desk that the entire surface of the desk is post-it note material.
Not individual post-it note, one giant piece of paper.
It's one giant piece of paper that's on a thick pad that's like 2 inches thick.
And it looks like a yellow sticky pad.
Yeah, it's a big yellow thing, you know, and you're just like, oh, and you sit down and you can just draw. And it was by a Milan-based design firm called Soup Studio.
Yeah. And it's really more like an art/concept piece at first, right?
But then people looked at it and like, man, I'd love to have that desk. And so now they're making it viable. You have to call them for pricing. But it's, you know, you sit down at your desk and you just draw all over the desk. And then you just peel off the page.
Did you ever use a calendar?
One of those pad things.
The calendar pads? I used those in that sense.
Yeah, they were pretty useful.
But I never thought to turn it over and get rid of the actual.
Well, the odd thing is that, like, on the iPad and stuff like that, they're sort of emulating this. A lot of the same visuals are of that desk pad, you know, the calendar desk pad that you used to have. And, it was a useful thing.
Now
we see it digitally, but.
My family manages all of our activities via a large calendar that I post on the wall.
I've seen that
like
on your wall,
right?
Yeah.
And I make those just from recycled posters.
Yes.
Well, it's amazing how complex it gets. All these dates, and I've got three kids, and, you know, it gets full.
It's really nice
to have a big visual like that.
Yeah.
But a desk like this, the thing that frustrated me about this post-it note desk, it sounds great, except that I start stacking stuff on my desk, and I know that it would be like, okay, gotta get the phone off, gotta get my laptop off, gotta get the hard drive off. You have to remove everything from it. But at the same time, my desk is so cluttered I don't get to be creative on it, right? I have like a secondary desk that's for creativity.
Right.
So I can imagine my drafting table, which I never draft on, having post-it note surface. I think that'd be very cool.
Well, it's also good. Like, I could see, you know, I know my daughter would love a desk like this. Just stick it there and she would just draw and just...
Oh, yeah. The more paper, the better.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, Alex, do you want to tell us a little bit about something more depressing?
More depressing? I wouldn't say necessarily more depressing. Let me ask you, have you played video games much in your life?
I used to quite a bit. Yeah. Then I had children.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
I'm familiar with this.
I've wasted tons of time. When you had children.
Yeah, I think there's a great photo of me with Wyatt in one of those backstrap things, and I'm like, I'm kneeling at a computer and clearly playing a video game with him on my back, probably for hours. I probably destroyed myself doing that. But yeah, I did too much computer games. And now I try not to start playing computer games, because if I do, I'll never be seen again.
Yeah. Once you realize you have that, you know, I mean, I don't install them on my computer. I have them on the iPads and stuff, but I don't on the computer, because I know, you know, having grown up playing Asteroids and Galaga and Robotron and Tempest, you know, I put more quarters into those things.
Zelda. I did a lot of Zelda.
Yeah.
Well, quick question. Do you guys regret the time you spent on playing these games?
You know, at some point I said I have, but now that I'm in academia and part of what we study is computer games and games and playable media, it's a whole research field, I find that it's really useful that I have that knowledge. But I guess, I don't know if I regret it. I can definitely imagine the other stuff I could have done and wish I'd done that, like maybe finish a GeekSpeak website so that it was working better.
I wouldn't want to be blind to the subject of video games.
You wouldn't want to be blind to it, but maybe, have you spent too much time on it?
I think that missed basically
took a year out of your life
than I really needed to use up. Yeah. But aside from Myst, you know, I think it was important to play. You can't shut be a, you know.
Yeah. Well, Jane, I'm going to totally butcher her name, McGonagall. She's a game designer, and a lot of the games she's worked on, I haven't really played, but you know, they're out there.
Mm-hmm.
And she did a keynote at a presentation for the Games for Change conference. And there's a website for Games for Change, which is an interesting idea. You know,
that's really cool.
They're looking at games that are more than just your brain dead. You know, kind of games for a certain purpose, for mm-hmm. changing how you think, for improving how you think, or for
changing the world,
changing things, mm-hmm. you know, creating change. And she kind of goes into the ideas and exploring this notion of when you are on your deathbed, will you regret the time you spent playing games? And she goes into discussing a study where they ask people, what are the biggest things you regret? What are the top five things you regret from your life that you wish you had done? And playing games really wasn't on that list. And in fact, most of the lists were, you know, not enjoying life more or other things where the way she looked at it didn't necessarily have to do with games.
Right.
But the way she looked at it is games can help
fulfilling
yeah. those needs. If you right. look at the types of games, there are games that can fulfill those needs.
Well, doesn't this come to the question of whether looking back in your life, you appreciate the time that was joyous in the moment or the time that you look back on and are proud of? I mean, there's a big difference there on spending 9 hours playing a video game, which during that time, you're very much engaged in enjoying yourself. Mm-hmm. And then right afterwards going, oh, I just lost a day. Right? There's a big thing there that happens, but isn't that true in any type form of entertainment?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, a lot of the forms of entertainment have a more definitive endpoint. You know?
Yeah.
But
I mean, I think we're as geeks kind of motivated by learning, right? Mm-hmm. So if we're in a situation where we spend 9 hours on something and all we got out of that is more information, that was a good time.
Yep.
And so sometimes those games are like that. I think some of the Games for Change kind of concept definitely are important. I recall a few games that very much felt like a cinematic experience afterwards, and it felt like I was done, and I liked that aspect. Portal was a good example of that. Besides being extremely nauseous afterwards, I did enjoy the storyline and that it was done,
right.
Which some games don't have that kind of closure.
Yeah, that's actually where a lot of games over the years have had that kind of storyline. Mm-hmm. You know, when it's done, and you know, you're more or less... Don't have to spend more time on
right. There's something
although some of those can
it,
take
good.
Several days, if not weeks, to get to that point. But
yeah.
you know,
so her perspective is that you don't regret it.
Her perspective is of the things people talk about what they regret on their deathbed. Games is not listed among those, but in actuality, games can help address some of those things. And looking at ways of using games to improve our lives, such that when we look back on them, we feel better about. What we've done with our lives, you know, even things like spending time with family. Games don't necessarily have to mean video games. This is just games in general. So playing with your kids more, you know, things
well,
like
that's,
that.
That's I think that study came out of Australia, and nursing homes or hospices. And one of the top things was people regretted not spending more time with their family, or they mm-hmm. regretted working so hard. They wish they hadn't worked so hard.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So that was like the top thing that people regretted on their deathbeds. Yeah, wish
games,
I hadn't worked so hard.
And games are great for a lot of things. I mean, I actually use a site called Lumosity where it's just games designed to exercise different ways for processing information.
Yeah.
So it helps with things like improving your memory, your ability to process things more quickly, the ability to calculate things, solve problems, identify. It's just improving
a while ago we covered
the processing
a story,
speed of your brain effectively.
Right. A while ago we covered a story on games helping autistic people with social interaction, mm-hmm. right? Whether that is a possibility.
Yep, exactly. So it's just neat to look at it from a perspective of games not just being a waste of time, but actually different types of games can be used to actually help things more, or help people more.
Geek Speak on KOSP is supported by the Culture Council of Santa Cruz County. The Culture Council provides grants and supports artists and arts organizations throughout the Santa Cruz County. More information is available at ccscc.org. Again, that's ccscc.org, Cultural Council of Santa Cruz County. Or you can call them at 475-9600. We're going to do a Geek Bit in a second. And Geek Bits, of course, are things that are fun to look at online, not so much to hear on the radio. So we prime you to go look at cool videos and stuff. Alex got something interesting on Blade Runner, and I'm sure Alex will have something as well. My name's Lyle Troxell, and I do have Alan Luckow and Alex Slias in the air room with me. We are just doing news today because we do not have a phone answer. You're welcome to send us email if you'd like anytime during the week, and we will answer questions. Our email address is geeks@geekspeak.org, but please don't tell any spammers. You can also find that information out and everything we talk about on geekspeak.org. We're also supported by Dr. Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in handcrafted dentistry from start to finish, using digital technology for less radiation, and offering one appointment, crowns, and veneers. Information about Dr. Henry J. Ramirez is at 423-2447 or his website, RamirezDDS.com. Al, what's going on with Blade Runner?
Yeah, this is pretty cool. I mean, if you're familiar with the movie Blade Runner, or even if you are not, it's a pretty cool movie. You should be familiar with it, so let's just move on.
If you're not familiar with Blade Runner, what's wrong with you?
Yes. Anyhow, a guy took a segment of this movie and he painted 3,285 watercolor paintings of frames, you know, depicting the actual
like
scenes.
Like animation?
Yeah, he animated them. So he put them in sequence. So it's like over 3,000 watercolor paintings. And he seamed them together to be you know, an animation depicting these scenes from Blade Runner, and it's really cool.
And then uses the soundtrack from the original movie.
And he uses the soundtrack and plays that along. So basically, you're watching the movie, but it's like a watercolor.
Is the scene with the tortoise test thing? Is that in there?
Yes, where they have to try to test. One of the things in the movie is where they kind of have to test people to figure out if they're a replicant.
Right.
And so you could be a robot, but you look just like a person. So you go through a series of questions that say, you know, and based on your answers, they can tell whether you're a replicant or not. And as the movie goes on, it gets harder and harder. But and that's part of what this animation is. It's totally, I mean, it sounds weird. This guy did it all by hand.
I love that kind of work.
But the video is, we're going to post it on our links.
Geekspeak.org. Mm-hmm. Now, about the timeline, if you're listening to this live on the radio, it's going to be a while before Geekspeak.org is up with this show because my laptop's dead. But if you're on podcast, hey, it's up right now. All right, come on.
Geekspeak.org. Yeah, you're listening to it. Yeah. Your laptop's dead.
Alex, you got a geek bit?
Geek bit? I don't know if I've got a bit.
Okay, well, let's move on to the news then. It's as simple as that. It's very similar in a sense. Yeah, let's go to the news right now. Your first news story, sir.
All right. Well, again, coming back to the idea of cameras and photography, since I do like to dabble in that a little. How many megapixels do you have in your camera?
I have a D7000. I'd have to look it up. I don't know.
Okay, you're probably in the 15 to 16 range.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just got the new 5D Mark III from Canon.
You did?
Yeah.
Ooh. Full frame.
It's
how
nice.
Is it?
I love it.
Yeah? Is it?
Anyway, that's you, okay, that's we'll get that.
Did you bring it with you?
Yes, it's in the car.
All right, we'll go play.
But anyway, I've got 20, I think it's 22 megapixels, mm-hmm. 22 point something. How would you like to have a gigapixel?
I don't know if I would. That's a lot. Wait, that's
where
not a that's not
file?
A commercial product.
When you take the picture, the light's dim.
Yeah.
You suck the light out of the room.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, DARPA is actually funding research at Duke. So this is a little bit more, makes a little bit more sense. You know, the people who helped make the internet exist. they're working on camera research on basically taking lots of micro sensors for cameras and putting them all together inside a big box,
mm-hmm.
and putting a big large lens in front of it, and then using all of those sensors, capturing all the data and more or less stitching it together, but not in a lot of ways what the people have been doing is actually having lots of different cameras. But I can't imagine getting to gigapixel and the cost related to doing that sort of thing.
Not one sensor.
Not to mention the challenges of aligning all the images just right and all that.
What would be a good application for a big, big picture like that?
How about surveillance?
I'll go with surveillance.
You could watch, you know,
the planet.
Several city blocks, and they have some example images where they show a range of a city shot from some high up building. And they pull in a little, what looks like on a normal image would be maybe 5 pixels, but they just expand it out and you can read street signs from you know, a half a mile away or a mile away.
Wow, that's a lot of data.
It's crazy.
It'd be fun for large group shots, right? Where you could look at people's pores.
Yes.
I mean, it's kind of excessive.
It's important to look at those things.
Yeah, let's just 12 start pixels doing per video pore. At that resolution. You know, the resolution. Yeah.
So to be clear, can you tell me what, earlier you said yours is like, well, the Nikon D7000, the camera I use, is a 16.2 MP, which is megapixel. Mm-hmm. Can you say what that means?
Okay, 1 pixel is 1 dot. Megapixel is 1 million dots, roughly. Gigapixel is 1 billion dots. So imagine, you know...
So it's a lot bigger.
Most people have your camera... Your average camera is what? Maybe 5
well,
to 10 megapixels
iPhone,
now?
Well, let's say the iPhone camera. A lot of people have that. It's a 6-megapixel camera, I think.
Well, I think the 4S is 8.
Oh, yeah, the 4S is 8. Okay. So that means that there's 8 million dots for every image.
To form the image, exactly.
So that's the interesting thing is that... You know, people say, oh, it's just 8 million. We know that word, but we conceptually in our brain can't actually hold that much data. So the idea of what 8 million means. But well, when you do start looking at pixels in an image, you do kind of get a feeling for how big that
yeah,
is.
Yeah, and for another, you know, example is an HD TV that's about 2 megapixels.
Mm-hmm. So the 1080p can't.
1080p, it's okay. About
so when you're 2 looking megapixels. At your HD can when you're looking at your HD screen at home, if you've got a high-end one, you're looking at 2 million pixels on the screen, and it makes a really sharp, beautiful picture.
Yeah, now take 500 of those.
500 that's screens. Gigapixel. That's a gigapixel. That's a big monitor. Mm. Now, I went to the Cinema 9 in town, along with a lot of local businesses, does this flashback series on Thursday nights, I think once a month or something of that nature, maybe every week, where they do a film from the past. And we all went and saw Back to the Future, which was awesome. And they are calling it a 4K image. What does that mean?
4K?
Does that mean it's 4,000 pixels high?
I'm not sure if they actually display it that, but yeah, it's basically lines.
Lines. So yeah. It's like the 1080p is 1,080
right.
pixels
they,
lines.
A lot of most theaters, I think, run at 20, you know, the 2048 range in that range, and then there's the 4K.
The 4K is one of them. All right, interesting. I was just kind of curious about that. All right, so that's a very large picture. Soon to be, probably not soon to be released. Well, it's much more research. Yeah, but
this is probably more going to have military applications and, you know, various government surveillance applications, I'm sure, at first.
That's how it definitely. Starts.
Well, since we're talking about cameras and we mentioned the iPhone, Al, you got an iPhone camera story?
Oh, there's a neat little device that it's called GoPano or GoPano.com. But this thing clips onto your phone on the lens part. And it was developed out of Carnegie Mellon University, and this is available now, and it's a product. It's reasonably priced.
And it works on multiple phones, really, I think.
Yeah, it works on multiple phones, and it works in conjunction with an app. And if you can imagine, it's like a weird-shaped, reflective, mirrored surface, and it just goes right on top of your lens, and it gets this weird, you know, if you ever walk by, like a ball.
Well, like a Christmas tree ornament, one of those glowing Christmas trees. You get all stretched out and weird.
Right. So you can see the image in there, but it's all weird. Well, this does that, but it takes in 360 degrees, and then the app corrects the weirdness so that it turns it back into what we would normally see. So it's basically creating a 360-degree video. So you can...
Oh, neat.
You can record a video... And as you walk around, it's basically doing the entire circle. And then the way the videos come out, they're sort of interactive. So you can be watching it and then touch it and then move it and then see the other side of, you know, what's being shown.
Hmm.
So it's a pretty neat little thing, very reasonably priced.
Well, it shouldn't be that expensive. Piece of plastic and some metal and some spray paint.
And
software.
And software.
Yeah, it's a neat little thing, little app.
And it's called GoPano. Go what?
GoPano.
GoPano. So like panoramic. Makes sense. I do a lot of pano stuff on my camera because when I want to capture a lot of people in a room, kind of get a feel for a party, you know, for a Facebook post or just for my own journaling, I'll do a pano of the whole space.
Right.
And it takes a while because you got to kind of move your camera. And there's a few great apps to do that.
Yes.
That kind of stitch it automatically for you as you go.
Dermander,
but this would be kind of cool to do video.
Right.
I could imagine, you know, a 10-second video of a party would be a really kind of a neat thing to keep to represent
the party.
Oh, that
would be cool. Yeah, like a concert or something.
Yeah, exactly. A concert.
You can see the group.
Who is around you.
Turn around and see the people cheering and back and forth.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know what would be really helpful for an application like that?
Hmm.
More pixels.
Yeah, you know what?
That's true. It's true. It's not going to be that high resolution.
Yeah, you do lose a little bit in that translation.
Well, it's a 1080p probably original video for the 4S.
Yes.
So if you think of it as multiple small, it's going to be pretty small.
It's, yeah. You know.
It's kind of cool, though.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we've seen that kind of thing before, and I wouldn't mind getting one. Actually, there's one of the Kickstarter projects I did was a robotic panoramic thing. It takes your iPhone, you sit in this cradle, and actually turns and takes photographs for you.
Which ultimately
which
would
is
be a
cool.
higher quality.
But it wouldn't be video, and it would be one-directional.
Yes.
Right? Yeah.
You did,
definitely.
Or you helped fund?
I helped fund, and I'm waiting for mine. You know how it is, a Kickstarter. Yep. Kickstarter is a website where you can look at cool projects that are pending and you can invest in them. And if enough money comes along to launch the project, your investment goes through. And if it crashes, your investment doesn't go through. And most of the time they provide, in the Kickstarter projects, they provide some kind of payback for the people that invest. And normally it's one of the products if it's a cheap product. So,
you know, I have a tech question, actually, now that Alex is here.
Well, there's no calls today, so you can go ahead
and
fill in,
please.
Well,
I can do the call.
Yeah.
Oh. Hello.
Hello, you're on air. This
yeah,
is a
GeekSpeak. I have a question. Actually, what it is a friend of mine from years ago, she sent me an email, and it told me to go to the site and check out this great new thing. And obviously, it was somebody, a virus had gotten into her machine and accessed her address book and spammed everybody with stupid thing, you know.
Right.
Really. And so when I get it, I'm like, oh, she got, you know, snared.
She got, yeah.
And she's got like a Dell, which, you know, runs Windows mm-hmm. and that. And I emailed her and said, you know, you've been hacked and you've got a virus and all this kind of stuff. So she's like, oh no, what do I do? You know? And I'm like, well, you could buy a Mac or you could, you know. But at the same time, I think, you know, what could somebody do? I mean, because, you know, you can't just buy a new computer just because right. you're being hacked, and you're going to have to chase viruses if you're on PC platforms.
The easiest thing at this point, she's got to make sure she does Windows updates, and I would install Microsoft Essentials.
Essentials.
Security Essentials,
yeah.
Or Sophos, or, you know, one of these mm-hmm. antivirus things, and they will probably capture it and say and fix the machine and repair it. But that address book is out in the wild now,
yeah.
And there's nothing you can do about it. In fact, it's very common for a spammer to use the knowledge of that account to then, you know, because the data is theirs automatically, right?
Right.
And then send messages to them from her account. So
right.
you're going to see a lot of spam from that yeah. woman, unfortunately.
Well, I mean, the thing is that you're going to see spam. Anyway, your yeah, email address right. has been leaked somewhere.
Oh, yeah. Always.
The thing that they've actually gained is understanding the relationships.
Your social network.
Yeah, mm-hmm. exactly. I mean, mm-hmm. Knowing that social network makes it easier to manipulate you.
Yep.
And so, I mean, there are people who fall for that all the time. And I mean, I've seen, I've actually seen emails in presentations when I've gone to security discussions mm-hmm. where they email. Knows, I mean, actually says, hey, I got, you know, I'm a friend of your brother's, you know, and then put the first name. It's like, I heard about your aunt, you know, it's like, you know, oh, yada, man. Yada,
wow.
yada.
It's like, and it's all know, automated, probably.
Here's something that can really help kind of, you know, capture some of your memories, you know, check this out. You know, here's I attached a PDF to kind of help collect up some of those things. And the guy, look, this guy's a security researcher, and he looks, he's like, this is really fishy, but wow, this knows a lot about me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And what he ended up realizing is he went to his Facebook account, and literally right around the time of the email, there was an article he had posted about his aunt or something he posted about his aunt and or his great aunt. That's what it was.
Right.
And actually, I think it even said great aunt in the email. And his brother was the first one to comment on it. And it was something about how I forget what it was about the aunt, but
right, right.
but basically,
but he saw the way it was built.
They mined information out of Facebook, and whether or not I don't even know if his page is public, but you know, if any of your friends have their computer hacked, they can get that
that's
information.
That's what I was thinking exactly.
So,
this is one of those things.
Set security settings as private, you need to assume the information you put out there
is public.
Is public.
I mean, well, this is the thing that's so tricky about this. It used to be that if someone was extremely wanted to, you know, get some information from somebody, they do social engineering, right? And they'd look up their family experience, they'd find out if they bought a house in town, and basically you can get this giant profile, like an investigator in profile, which is all public data. And then a person can address you in a way that seems like you have more information about you, right? And then you get a trust level with them. And that whole process is normally, traditionally, extremely intensive for the attacker, right? The attacker has
so
to collect a lot of data. Now, it's not something someone has to do. It's
now
all programmatic.
You go to a search engine, a specialized search engine where, you know,
well,
you
you're still saying
a name and you know everything about
but
the
you're
person.
Still assuming that a person's actually doing it. What I'm saying is that we're getting to the point where it's now algorithms
doing
it.
It's definitely automated, yeah.
Yeah, and that automated process makes it really tricky because all you have to do is have a mistake every once in a while where, wow, a person knows my first name, my last name, where I went to school, and my sister's name, and they want to know something about something else.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I trust them pretty much right away. What you have to start doing is going, no, you can't trust them. You have to have something even more reliable. You need to have a social captcha, if you will.
Yeah,
which brings us back to the Blade Runner replicant example.
Yes.
Of knowing whether it's a person or a robot.
Speaking of that kind of whether it's a person or a robot, today is a special day with regards to that question.
Ooh.
And the first question that was ever asked is the Turing test. Alex, you know the idea of the Turing test?
Yeah.
Can you describe it to me?
The Turing test? I'm not sure I could describe the Turing test. You go for it.
Okay, I'll go for it. The idea being that if you can't tell the difference in someone that you're interacting with, let's say via text, but you can't tell the difference if the person is automated, a machine, some kind of automaton, or if they're an individual. If you personally as a human being can't decide that, then you have to assume that they do have an intelligence, they do have a self-awareness. So though I don't know if Al is a robot or not, I assume that he's a human being because there's no way for me to detect that he's not a human being. And so if your communication style is through text, for example, the Turing test basically says if humans cannot determine if the thing they're talking to is a sentient creature or not, and they think that it is sentient, then it is sentient. It's kind of the definition of what sentience is.
That sounds flawed.
It sounds flawed, but it's also in the same sense, I don't know that you're sentient. You might just be really good at responding to me.
Yeah, but
right? It
assumes the problem with that is it assumes your infinite ability to detect
sentience. No, it says there's no way to really determine whether something's sentient or not unless you're it. And therefore, the only way to determine that is to interact with it. And the best people to decide to interact with it or not would be other people. So the only reason we all assume that the other people have sentience is because of our interactions with them, and we make that assumption.
See, I don't agree with the best ones to determine that being other sentient people.
Well, who would it be then?
I can see even because we're flawed in ourselves and we are
absolutely
not good at assessing
no,
things.
Absolutely.
I actually think
there is no difference on me treating you like a sentient and a computer that I treat like a sentient if I think of them as the same. From my experience, if it's a computer or it's something else,
sure.
If it's the same as your interaction, it's just as validly sentient as you are from my perspective.
Mm-hmm.
That's the basic concept of the Turing test. Anyway,
okay.
Alan Turing, 100 years old today,
yeah.
I think.
Wow.
Oh. Yeah,
If he were alive.
Yes. He's not, and no sentient computers are alive either. No one's actually been able to effectively pass these tests.
That yes. you know about.
That we know about. Well, we were talking about something kind of related to that. Oh, computer systems are getting really good at tricking people.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Right.
Doesn't that make you just want to take all your information off Facebook or... I mean, when you think about stuff like that, they're able to just...
It's already out there.
Yeah.
There's nothing
once
you can
once it's
do.
There, it's there. I mean,
well, and then you find out a company gets hacked and all the data gets stolen and you had nothing to do with it except that you were a customer of theirs
right.
once long ago.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, your information's out there. It's being put into massive data mining systems. I mean, even in the commercial industry, the big hype right now is big data. It's a phrase that's being tossed around is being able to analyze massive amounts of data that companies have.
We need more legislation on this problem.
Oh, I agree with that.
I definitely feel. You have a story kind of related to this.
Sure. We've got, it's kind of tying into an app for a phone. There's an Android app out there that was created by a security researcher. And this was actually created as a demonstration. A lot of people will say that's irresponsible, but if he can do it, someone who's going to use it for bad purposes can do it and probably has.
Mm-hmm.
So I view it as kind of good to get the information out there to put pressure on people to address the problem.
Right. You're basically saying people that spend time looking at security models, break them, and publicly say, "Hey, this is broken,"
and this is
allows
how
people
I broke
to fix it. Right.
Yeah, and not just saying it is broken because we've heard this with companies for the longest time where they end up saying. We're having bugs in their software, Microsoft Windows, bugs in their software being reported to them, not doing anything about it for 1-2 years. you know what happened when they finally were actually responding and fixing these things? People started publishing the vulnerability. That pressured the companies
to actually fix
things. And now that is the standard practice for reporting bugs. You tell the company, and you wait a period of time to give them a chance to fix it, and then you publish the information.
Right.
And if they don't fix it, it's the company's fault for not addressing it. They've had fair warning.
Right. Okay.
We have a security researcher that went and has done research, and this is not anything new, but the credit cards where you can just kind of swipe it and pay for your gas or pay for the different things that have the wireless proximity sensor for the credit card. It's been known that these things are going to be vulnerable. It kind of has to be. It's easy to get the basic information off the card. With some basic stuff, you can either the phones that come enabled with this sort of proximity technology, or you can even buy adapters that connect to the phone and this app. You can actually steal basic credit card information, like the credit card number and the bank it's for. I mean, a lot of the details for that. Just by getting close to the credit card, and you could pass somebody
on the street.
Walk by somebody in the street, you got your phone in their pocket, they got their wallet in their pocket, it just collects the information as you go by.
It has their name, it has their credit card number.
Yep. Hmm. Now, this might scare people, but if you really think about it, it's not a very effective means. I mean, literally, you have to have close proximity to the card. It means you have, I mean, it's likely to happen, but in limited effect.
Yeah.
You're going to have the small time, because it's easy to do, but you're going to have the small time person trying to create credit fraud. Big time people, where it's actually going to be a larger risk to general community, they're not looking at getting individual picking ones here and there. What they're going to be looking at is just massive databases that they can hack into.
Like Sony.
Exactly. Exactly. Right. So, I mean, this is not something to be paranoid or, you know, worried about. It is a risk, but the likelihood of it being a big risk to any individual is fairly small.
Well, especially considering credit cards, traditionally any loss on the card is actually incurred by the company, not by the individual. So there's that whole protection as well, that you're not really going to get hit by somebody taking your credit card information.
Although, I mean, part of this is to help point out that when, you know, there's a lot of thoughts about, oh, well, let's get rid of paper money. You know, make it all proximity sensors within your phone. I can pay for things and it's linked to your bank account.
All right, Al, you've got a bit of a security news story, I believe.
Oh, yeah, actually kind of similar in a way. It's coming out of a company called Ford, which...
What do they do?
Some kind of vehicle.
Like transportation devices?
Transportation vehicle they make. And they have a lot of things that they're adding into their cars that do automation. I'm sure everybody's heard of the things where you just walk in and things, you know, the car automatically knows it's you because you're wearing the key and then it turns itself on and everything like that. Well, they've actually expanded their reach now into just general consumer computer usage, so that they've got an app. And now this app works on, it needs to have a Mac, and you also need to be using Google Chrome, and you need a Bluetooth-enabled handset. But what it does is you open up the app, and you enter in all your passwords. Okay.
There's a reason for that.
And then you walk up to a computer, Bluetooth-enabled computer, and open up Chrome, and allow it to your phone to access it. And it basically, anything you go to that requires your password, it will automatically fill in.
So it's a password manager that's on your phone and uses Bluetooth to... So the computer itself isn't actually storing...
No, it's not even your computer. Say it's somebody else's computer. And then when you walk away, it automatically deactivates every and logs out of anything you were in.
If
you walk away. So it's a move from Ford to take their technology that they developed for their cars, and they're you know, moving it into a consumer
the keyless
realm.
Entry stuff, right? Keyless start.
You know?
Sweet.
And so it's funny when you talked about, you know, just walk in next to somebody. Yeah. This is like walking up to a computer and just, I'm going to check my Facebook.
Who you are.
You just walk up, type in your, you know, Facebook thing, and it knows who you are and everything. You do it. Okay. Well, and then you walk away and it just disconnects.
It's interesting. It's automating something I do. I use this application called 1Password. I'm also trying LastPass. But 1Pass, I have the app on my phone. So any of my passwords are actually extremely complex, random things that I don't actually know. My phone has a database that's encrypted, and I know 1Password for that. Mm-hmm. And so when I come to a computer, for me to log into something, I actually have to do the interaction of looking it in my phone and then grabbing it and putting it on. And then I think Google is now doing this authenticator, which is basically a number that changes every minute, that the algorithm to make that number is on my phone and also on their systems. Hmm. And so I have to use that number to authenticate. It's a second form. What is it called? Alex, you know about security.
I know a lot of VPNs use that stuff.
Well, the secondary number, like Secure ID used to be one of those. It's a second authentication token.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's a way of enforcing. I have to use my password and this number that gets changed every minute. So you have to have my phone basically to log into my account on Google.
That's a way to ensure, I mean, the basic concepts of authentication, or factors of authentication, you've got the things you know, the things you have, and the things you are.
Right.
You are being biometrics. You have being something you need possession of in order to work. And that makes, that's
so
what that does.
So this thing by Ford is basically saying, let's take that process one step closer. Mm-hmm. Let's make the communication through Bluetooth between the two devices.
It's called Ford Key Free, by the way.
Right, of course. They labeled it nice and well. I'm sure they put money into it. Ford's been spending a lot of money on technology. It makes a lot of sense that they've done that. Yeah. I like the idea of it. I used to have a lock screen that was initiated that way. I set up an Apple script that detected my Bluetooth ID. Huh. And if I walked away for my computer, my screensaver would come on instantaneously.
That's a cool idea.
And then I'd be in screen lock, right? Yeah. And then I actually set it up also to work so that it would unlock my screen if I had Bluetooth ID.
That's even better. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the flaw, because the Bluetooth ID is not a unique thing at all. You need another level, because anybody can take a Bluetooth device and say, actually, that's my MAC address too, and then all of a sudden unlock my screen. So I disabled that, but it was a cool concept, and assuming you'd build it correctly, not relying on the Bluetooth ID, but actually something the Bluetooth is sending.
Well, yeah, if you store a passphrase on the device and then sync it, it being the same passphrase on the computer, that would kind of...
Yeah, but you've got to assume that the communication protocol that's between the device and the computer is secure enough such that any computer that says, I can look at your secure... passphrase?
You can actually save using encryption keys to actually communicate
that key
exchange.
Right. It's just the authentication of the phone knowing that the computer is a valid app on the app. That's tricky. Also, if the computer has been cracked, its memory space is not safe. So it's one of those things where it's a trust issue that you've got to decide on. Hmm. But it's cool. I like that idea. I think it's really funny how it's clearly, like you're reading your article, you're very clearly saying, hi, we're Ford. We're putting a lot of money in this space, and we're advertising this. You know, it's like, right. It very much feels like a marketing strategy. Yep. But the idea of it is awesome. I thought of it years ago, and I love the idea of it being around. Alex, that's the one.
Yeah, Alex.
He's Al.
I'm Al.
You're Alex.
Yes.
Go for it, sir. One more story from you.
Sure.
I think we're running out of time, but go for it.
All right. Young listeners for music are more and more, they're opting to listen to streaming music rather than owning music, which is interesting. I mean, I certainly... I'm listening. I listen to Pandora. You have all the different music sources. I don't tend to...
Turntable FM. Turntable.fm. Yeah. Awesome.
Well, I just don't like the... Unless they've changed it, I don't like that they actually require you to authenticate with Facebook.
Oh, no. I'm an early adopter of that, so I've got an account on there. But go on.
Anyway, they're moving more and more to where they don't own the music, which is an interesting concept because you're... in the situations where it's free, but you're giving up ownership of the music, which I thought was an odd, something I think a lot of people aren't thinking about, especially young listeners, because they don't have that context of that change. So you no longer will own your music, really. You're just always borrowing it. You know, there's no sense of ownership. There's no sense of having something that's yours.
You know, I was thinking that I was listening to someone on some podcast recently, and they were talking about, oh, I can't wait to own that movie. I didn't like it that much, but I can't wait to own it. And I do not have that feeling about needing to own something. I mean, the idea that if it's available somewhere, that seems to be much more safer for the day. The stuff I care about is if I have the only copy, then I want to share it, right? Like, it's just this...
But you're also assuming it's going to be available somewhere.
Yeah, that is a tricky thing. There are amazing collections of music that are not around.
Yeah, and I mean, if you think about it, there's a lot of movies that are only available now on limited basis. Disney releases certain movies only once in a while.
It's true.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff.
You're listening to Geek Speak. We're closing up the show, but we do have a crazy device of the week this week. On the air with me is Alex Lias and Al Luck. I'm Lyle Troxell. Car Talk on KOSP is coming up next, and it's made possible by a grant from the Carmel Bach Festival, celebration of music and ideas, July 14th through 28th, featuring over 70 events, 8 of which will be under the baton of Maestro Paul Goodwin. Full details and tickets at bachfestival.org. I was thinking, Al, if you could do a crazy... it's a new connector type from Apple.
Thunderbolt.
Thunderbolt. Crazy Thunderbolt of the week.
Crazy Thunderbolt device of the week. Okay, that's silly. There are no Thunderbolt devices out there. There's a couple of spare hard drives. But the one thing I am going to talk about is a crazy USB device, which I ran across. And what it is a cockroach. You can get a USB charged cockroach, which comes with a little remote control. It goes forward, backward, left, and right. We're going to have a link to this on the website. And I got to tell you, it's very creepy. I mean, especially if you get a bunch of these things, you just turn them on and move them around. It is unreal.
That's at geekspeak.org.
Yes.
And here's Car Talk. Thanks, Al.